everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, Hi, I'm Julie, and I really can't talk this morning very well.
And welcome to the A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie underneath.
Yes, that's what we do. And
we haven't done it for a while.
Yeah,
but
just a little bit. Sorry, folks, yeah. I've been so busy. But this is episode number 19, and we're going to talk about Declare by Tim Powers.
Monster book.
It is a monster book from
Baron
von Longbuckenstein, right?
I know. Well, you didn't know. And it forced me to read Tim Powers, and this was a great book.
Oh, it was fantastic. And kudos to the Kurt Jester for recommending it. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Jeff.
What an excellent experience this was. It was fantastic. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and it's written in a Jean Le Carré style of spy story, and that's not my deal. So I remember starting this before and never getting through it, but this forced me to push past to the spot where I went, oh my gosh, what a great book. So double thanks for me.
You bet. Well, should we jump right in?
Let's go.
Okay, I think the best way to describe this book is the author's note at the end. Let me just read the first couple of paragraphs. It's not spoilery, but it tells you pretty much exactly what this book is. Tim Powers says, being a John Le Carré fan, I happened one day to read his introduction to The Philby Conspiracy by Page, Leach, and Knightley, and I was so struck by the mysteries surrounding Kim Philby and his father that I read that book, and then Boyle's The Fourth Man, and it soon became evident to me that a novel could be woven around these characters and events. Eventually, I discovered that, in fact, novels such as Ted Alibari's Fine, The Other Side of Silence had already been. But as I went on to read Eleanor Philby's Kim Philby, The Spy I Married, I'm about to sneeze, excuse me, and Borovic's and Modin's books providing the KGB perspective, and Philby's own My Silent War, I found that the incidents that intrigued me were apparently peripheral ones. I kept being nagged by a feeling that the central element of the story had been almost completely omitted, to be derived now only by finding and tracing its fugitive outlines. In that way, I arrived at the plot for this book using by the same method that astronomers use in looking for a new planet. They look for perturbations, wobbles in the orbit of the planets they're aware of, and they calculate mass and position of an unseen planet whose gravitational field could have caused the observed perturbations, and then they turned their telescopes on that part of the sky and searched for a gleam. I looked at all the seemingly irrelevant wobbles in the lives of these people: Kim Philby, his father, T.E. Lawrence, Guy Burgess, and I made it an ironclad rule that I could not change or disregard any of the recorded facts, nor rearrange any days of the calendar. And then I tried to figure out what momentous but unrecorded fact could explain them all. And I find that very interesting.
Wasn't it, though?
Yeah.
When I got partway into the book and Kim Philby pops up, I suddenly went, oh, and a piece fell into place because I knew just enough about, you know, oh, the British traitor to the Russians undercover all that time. And it helped a lot to know that, but I really left the afterword for afterword.
Right.
And which is a good thing, because if anyone's reading this book, don't read the afterword first. He spills the beans about a lot of stuff that you need to discover as the book goes along.
Yeah, sure enough.
Yeah, I was like, oh, no wonder it's written in that style. That was the 60s, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And the book is kind of, you really just have to be willing to stick with it, because he's shifting back and forth between three time periods in Andrew Hale's life. And Andrew
Hale
himself,
who does not appear, he's not a real historical character. Andrew Hale.
Yeah, he's fictional. Yeah. He's the wobble. He's part of the wobble.
He's part of the wobble, right.
But which is such a useful way to put it. But he himself doesn't understand a lot of what's going on most of the time. So you're kind of in his position, but it's told from current day in the book is 1968, I think. And then there's an event in around 1948, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think there was 41. Yeah,
there are the events leading up to this big thing in 1948 mm-hmm. on Mount Ararat. You know that from the beginning, mm-hmm. and then there's his growing up.
Right.
And most people are pretty clueless during their growing up anyway, and he's no mm-hmm. different. So you're told, and his is quite mysterious, and so you're going back and forth between these things. Only with just little spaces in the type to tell you. How was that listening to it? I listened to part of it, but it immediately to me was so confusing I had to switch to the written.
Well, again, as sometimes I've done here on Good Story, I've kind of found this method. You know, when I have the audiobook available and I've got the book available, which I did because I bought this book at a science fiction convention where I got to meet Tim Powers, probably about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I had the book declare. I bought it and had him sign it. And then, I just never got to it, but I wanted to. So I would listen some and read some, and sometimes I would read at the same time as I listened, and it grounded me in the audiobook so that, you know, I could put down the book and now I was into the audiobook. And I, you know, that's a kind of phenomenon with me in audiobooks is if I get in there, if it clicks with me, I could stick with it. Mm-hmm. It's become harder to stick with audiobooks lately. And I don't know if it's because I'm really busy or what's changed, but, you know, when I've connected with an audiobook, it's listening the whole thing is no problem. And that kind of happened here, but the way that I was able to do it was because it is a complex story, and I think complex audiobooks are very hard to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And but the narrator was excellent. His name is Simon Preble, and it allowed me to keep moving forward in the book at mm-hmm. times when I couldn't be reading. So that's what I love about audiobooks.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
In fact, our oldest daughter, Hannah, just got a job where she has to do a lot of driving all over the place. And it's wonderful because for so long I've been trying to get her to listen to some of these audiobooks that I've got, and she mm-hmm. just hasn't had the time. And now she said, I'm out of all the audio stuff I had. And I went, oh, wait, here's some. And she told me, Mom, I'm already on the fourth disc of Lamentation because I've been driving so much just this week. And I'm like, yay.
How neat.
But it's the same thing as she'll go back and forth.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
Anyway, that's all beside the point.
You bet. So just a quick thing. Kim Philby, who was Kim Philby? This is really neat for me because my dad, hi dad, I'm pretty sure he listens.
Hi Scott's dad.
There was a period probably like from 1980 to 1990 that he was very much into the spy stuff and not novels, the historical stuff. I knew who Kim Philby was just from talking to him. And so I got to talk to him a little bit about this. I just wish I wasn't so darn busy this past 3 weeks because I would have loved to have read some of the real history myself in preparation mm-hmm. for the podcast. But mm-hmm. but Kim Philby was one of what's called the Cambridge Five. They were five British agents who were actually double agents for the Soviet Union.
Oh.
So Philby, I don't know for sure when he got found out. And when he actually did defect to the Soviet Union.
And wasn't he suspected before he found out
and
defended himself mm-hmm. and then turned out to be one after? I don't know why I think that, but that's just
I didn't have time to look into it in detail, but
Scott's dad can tell us.
Heck yeah, you bet. One of the interesting things is they found out who four of the five were. And for mm-hmm. a very long time, they didn't know who the fifth one was. And it wasn't even until like the 1990s that they figured out who the fifth one was.
Wow, he must have been good.
Yeah, so super interesting.
Unfortunately. But
yeah.
But in hindsight, I can just go, wow.
Right, right. So the other members of the Cambridge Five are Donald MacLean, Guy Burgess, Anthony Blunt, and John Cairncross.
Now, Guy Burgess, he was a writer, wasn't he?
I don't know. Guy Burgess. Anthony Burgess is. Guy Burgess is.
Okay.
Yeah, a British-born intelligence officer and double agent who worked for the Soviet Union. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I just made that. I recall, I guess I
Oops.
Connected it to some other Burgess. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I recall Guy Burgess in this book. I think Anthony Blunt made an appearance. I don't remember Donald McLean or John Cairncross, though.
No.
But I could have missed him.
Yeah, Guy Burgess was definitely in there.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so fascinating. So from this interesting story of Kim Philby, Tim Powers writes this story around it. And the stuff that he's come up with to explain some of these strange things in his life...
Amazing.
Are in the fantastic realm.
And kind of almost in the echoes of H.P. Lovecraft.
I was going to say that very thing.
Okay.
Yeah, without question. No, don't be sorry. In the author's note at the end, you know, when you read it past it, it's obvious in the book too that he was influenced a lot by the Thousand Nights and One Night.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff about the djinn in there. DJINN.
Spoiler.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Late spoiler.
Oops.
Sorry.
My apologies.
Because to me, that was a huge revelation.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Oops. I mean, when they got
Should be a race.
In the book, and I was like, oh, that's what was on Mount Ararat.
Yes.
Got it. Plus something else. But,
right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
I was like. Yeah. What the heck is everybody doing mulling around and running away and jumping up and down and having horrible memories of something awful? And finally, about halfway through the book, this one word is dropped and you go, oh, all right. That helps a huge building block go in place because otherwise I just don't care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess it wasn't. I didn't consider it was a huge spoiler because I knew it was. This is a fantasy novel, right?
Right.
And I guess maybe the specific fact of what they were called was that, but I knew that there was going to be supernatural forces in play.
Yeah, but all anybody do is go, and their mind skittered away from that horrible night when his people died and he ran away or whatever, you know, and I'm just like, what?
And I was thinking, okay, this is something heavy and supernatural. That's what I thought. Okay.
So I knew that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, was it giant worms from under the earth?
Uh-huh.
Was it spacemen? Yeah. I mean, I didn't have any idea of what it was. So when it settled down into being that, and then, maybe we should just tell a little bit of the story now that we've done one spoiler, but just a bit of the story. And then. I don't know how one summarizes this.
Yeah, and that's why I was having trouble thinking that. That's why I read the author's note.
Let's see what
because I was like, you know, because the plot is so complex.
Well, let me just read some of the book jacket.
Okay.
Because it's all based around what the British love to call the great game, or they used to, and that was spying. And it was called that before, I do know, or I'm pretty sure, again, we could be corrected, but before World War I, when... they weren't formally gathered into any government group. You know, these gentlemen would go off and gather information on all their travels and they would tell it to the government. So it was called the Great Game because everyone was doing it. And it was kind of, it was dangerous, but it was also kind of intellectually challenging at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they call it that in this. And it says, after a 10-year hiatus, British academic Andrew Hale is abruptly called back into the Great Game by a terse, cryptic telephone message. Born to the trade and recruited at the age of 7 by a most secret service, Hale in 1963 is forced to confront again the nightmare that has haunted his adult life, a lethal unfinished operation codenamed Declare. Mm-hmm. 2 years earlier, as a young double agent infiltrating the Soviet spy network in Nazi occupied Paris, Hale first encountered the incomprehensible rhythms of an invisible world. And from that moment on, nothing was ever safe and knowable again. There also his life became eternally linked to two other lives that would recurrently intersect his at its most dangerous junctures. His comrade operative, the fiery and beautiful communist agent Elena Teresa Seniza Bendiga, the object of Hale's undying love, and Kim Philby, the mysterious traitor to the British cause and perhaps to all humanity. Mm. So I'll stop there. But
yeah.
But that at least gives you the idea of, You know, it's really done in that John le Carré style. And at one point I read all kinds of spy novels, especially in the 70s when they were really coming out a lot from all different sorts of authors. And his was one that was just so, I don't want to say, well, to me it just seemed so masculine. There was nothing soft about it. Hard-edged, I guess. And so I just didn't really like those as much as some of the other ones. Not that the other ones were.
I recall a movie with Sean Connery and Michelle Pfeiffer. Was it called The Russia House or something like that?
Could be, yeah.
Okay, I was just curious if you had seen that. No. I didn't know if those were accurate. You know, I haven't read a John le Carré book, but that movie was one of his.
Yeah, my parents would read them. And so I'd pick them up and try them and go, no, kind of like I did with Declare. So does Tim Powers, you said you've read On Stranger Tides, was his writing style completely different, I guess?
It was. It really was. And here it was more effective. On Stranger Tides was like a string of really cool events. You know, they were like really excellent scenes that you want to talk about with people afterwards, and they were strung together.
Okay.
But the book itself I found to be chaotic, and there were times where I'd read a paragraph and I'd have to read the paragraph again because I wasn't quite sure that I got it, or my mind wandered off or something. But this book, there was none of that. I was completely immersed from the first page. It was very easy to follow, and though the plot was complex, I was very much into it.
Yeah, it was really laid out fairly easily in terms of what was going on in each section. It's just it was very complicated.
Yeah,
especially since you're plunged into three different timelines without knowing what's going on, and the people in the timelines, especially the first, the later two, kept thinking about other things, like from when they were young, or you know,
and then that was interesting. There was a time I recall when I was listening to the audiobook that an event was happening that had been referred to by a previous character. And I started to wonder, am I at the right place in the audiobook? I mean, am I listening to the same thing over? Because what it turned out was it was a different character thinking about what had happened
in detail
from his or her perspective. And then later in the book, you're seeing that event now live, I guess, quote unquote, from a different character's perspective. And that kind of thing happened a few times.
Yes, it did. And there were several events that things centered around. One of them being in the 1940s when Andrew Hale is sent undercover as a communist agent. And that's when he first meets Elena, and because she is an honest-to-goodness communist agent, and he's like sending radio messages all night long to the Soviet Union, and he starts realizing somehow my messages aren't getting through, but it's for some weird reason, and sometimes I can't hear them usually, and finally he does manage to connect when I guess the atmosphere is just right, and then they're suddenly in great danger and they're having to wander around Paris trying to escape the people who are hunting them. And it's like, it's told in such an odd way, although you can imagine it, where like their footsteps fall into this odd cadence that's not really human. And it suddenly finds these echoes in some atmospheric thing and they know no people can see them. And you're just like, what? HP, are you there? HP Lovecraft, because it starts to become something he can't describe.
Right, right. And that first glimmer of the supernatural was when he was sending, when he finally got through, he started to send his Morse code in a cadence that matched his heartbeat. And he became entranced by it. And it was, Elena later said something like, oh, so you've discovered how to send long distances. And it had something to do. It was a supernatural connection or something that he was making with something that was not understandable. And, you know, whenever I think, you know, of something that's not understandable, you know, you think Lovecraft and, you know, all the stuff in his fiction is like that, where, you know, the horror is in the fact that we're insignificant. And, but I didn't ever get the feeling that it was almost the opposite in this book. He wasn't saying that we were insignificant.
Never.
Yeah, but yet these monsters were Lovecraftian in that way.
Well, yeah, it was that they were totally alien.
Mm-hmm.
And they despise us. I mean, that's the Lovecraftian thing, is that they despise us because we are so totally alien.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, though, there are ways that you can escape them, because there are things that have great power. And that, of course, has to be, I think, why Jeff Miller's like, you've got to talk about this book.
Mm-hmm.
Because, oh my goodness, the Catholicism in the worldview was everywhere.
Yeah, all the time.
Not such that it would upset anybody who wasn't Catholic, obviously, because I think this book is a big seller.
Uh-huh.
But it's in that sense that, you know, that everybody understands if you hold a crucifix up to a vampire, it's got the power to stop the vampire, or until these crazy modern vampires that in storytelling. But it's just that it's a real supernatural fact also. And the thing that was interesting to me is a lot of times you'll see people using those as, well, it's the one thing, it's the crucifix, it's this. But these people all had been Catholic at one time. And so it was almost like they had the Catholicism in their bones. So they had this inherent understanding of, well, if I had to declare myself an atheist, says Kim Philby, because I was raised Catholic and, or, you know, I was baptized. And once I was baptized, I lost my supernatural connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, everything that's mentioned in here, as far as I could tell, was absolutely theologically correct in a Catholic understanding of the sacraments and all that stuff. And those people also never denied it being true. They just were like, I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm now communist, therefore I must embrace atheism because God never did anything for me.
Mm-hmm.
But they all kind of fall back to it in their most extreme moments.
Yeah, one of the things that I underlined among many, many things was let's see, they were talking about a man who in his youth, this is not one of the main characters, a man who in his youth had aspired to be a Catholic priest. A certain spiritual perspective had by this time proved to be necessary in the highest levels of state security and espionage. That was fascinating all throughout. And like you said, they all had different degrees of Catholicism going on. You know, at one time, you know, one of the characters practically converts back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and one of the others is envious.
Does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the others is envious of her because he needs it. He can tell that he needs it. And, you know, wishes that he could do the same.
Well, and I mean, this is just a tiny spoiler, but I guess, but Kim Philby at one point, the thing that got me was, even though he had declared himself atheist, he made sure his four children were baptized.
Mm, yeah.
And he called it, let's see, I marked it, I think. He called what he was looking for a more profane sort of eternal life. And then it says, to his credit, he felt, Philby had actually tried to give his children the better sort of eternal life, though admittedly he had been maudlin drunk each time. Did it still count? He wondered now on this cold flank of Mount Ararat, if it was administered by a drunk, a resolutely atheist drunk? With the older four of his children, he had found opportunities to spill water onto their heads, and then, while seeming to try to wipe it off, covertly make the feared papist sign of the cross on their foreheads. He had cringed to do it, and his teeth had actually hurt each time as he had mumbled, I baptize thee in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, amen. But in the case of poor young Harry, his youngest son by his previous wife, Philby had eventually resorted to pushing the boy out of a rowboat. And it says on the way back into the boat, he, you know, muttered it under his breath while he made the sign of the cross on his head. So that's how, even though resolutely atheist, it's still taken as something that's absolutely true.
Yeah. And you can understand that, you know, with these entities or whatever.
Well, I think we have to get into spoiler territory.
Let's do
it. I mean, we've kind of done it already.
Yeah. All right. We're officially in spoiler territory, which is cool because there are a lot of cool things to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
But with these, jinn that are around. You know, they're hugely spiritual creatures. The fallen angels, right.
Which I thought was a brilliant explanation.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was. But how could you be faced with that all the time and not really believe in the possibility of God? You know, so it was almost as if Philby knew what was true, but couldn't bring himself to live in any way near the Christian way.
Well, and actually to regain, I think at one point in the book, he kind of says to regain his connection with them, which he's got to have for his work to work.
Yeah.
He has to deny God because they're like the black tear of man is in your heart. That's what the jinn call baptism, I think, is something like that. Mm-hmm. And so he's got to basically deny his baptism so that they'll again be able to communicate.
Mm.
And so he knows it's true because that's what was keeping him safe, in a sense.
Right, right.
I know for me, the thing that was fascinating also was, this was the thing that made me suddenly go, hey, was when they're hiding out, Elena and Hale are hiding out in Paris from the people chasing them, and you start seeing the things about Adam and Eve hiding in the garden.
Mm.
And over this phrase is used throughout the book. I heard thy voice in the garden and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself.
Yeah.
And so they'll say things about being naked and hiding yourself or being, we keep our clothes on tonight. And part of it's a practical, yes, we're a couple, but we're not doing anything because we have to be on alert. But part of it's that covert reference to there's something bigger at stake.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The knowledge that you're not supposed to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the prayer life of these folks is explored a little bit as well. When Elena, in particular, mm-hmm. gets into a very difficult situation,
yeah,
she starts to pray.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps. And it helps in the way that it helps in real life. You know? That's how I felt about it anyways.
Yeah, because she's trying to think of something, and the only thing that will come to mind is the Hail Mary. Is that the part you're talking about? Yeah.
Yeah, and then, but it helps her. And, I just had a thought that just flew out of my head for some reason. Oh. Oops. Anyway, it'll come back.
Because it's not that it's this miracle coming out and, you know, the light shines and everything's made easy.
Uh-huh.
It's exactly. Just that you can get through.
Oh, I recall now there was at least twice that I noted that Elena paused and waited for intervention from God. That
really?
Didn't happen. They weren't, you know, major events, but mm-hmm. she would be talking to Philby or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, there was one major scene where she was very down, and I don't know how much to spoil, but anyway, she was considering doing something. So mm-hmm. she was, and then Philby walked in the room, and now that I'm thinking about it, even though Philby is very snaky, that could have been the intervention she was looking for because there was a sentence while she was talking to Philby that she stopped. And waited for God's intervention. And when nothing happened, she continued mm-hmm. talking.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, okay, I'm going to give God a second here to interrupt this. And then mm-hmm. I'm going to keep going.
Yeah.
But she, at least twice, I recall twice. And I thought that was a very interesting thing that she did. She wasn't waiting for like a shaft of light. She was waiting for some kind of an interruption that would tell her mm-hmm. that she needed to not do what she was going to do.
Well, and the interesting thing too with Elena is she was probably, I think, the most honest atheist, or she was trying the hardest to be an honest atheist because she'd been so disillusioned by having everybody she knew killed. So she was fighting in Spain when she was a child.
Mm-hmm.
During the Civil War, and then the communists kind of scooped her up. And so she really rejected all that because her life had been ruined.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're a kid, that's the most obvious thing you can see as, where are you, God? And so the interesting thing is that at that crisis point where she's praying, she makes a solemn vow
to
the Virgin Mary. And she only told two people about that vow, and later on it becomes the turning point for the final revelation of the book,
mm-hmm.
of what is everyone's fate going to be.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah, just I just can't say enough good about this book. Sitting here talking about it, I'm just excited about it all over again.
Well, and the thing that got me too was one thing I wanted to say, that just about how the book was written,
mm-hmm.
and about how the plot continually drove forward,
mm-hmm.
but we're also fully in the time period. I mean, he's filling it in with all the little details you need to feel like, oh, this is kind of what the 60s was like, or this is what I've read the 40s was always like, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, I know you liked Blackout,
mm-hmm.
but that was the thing I complained about in Blackout, I felt, is that she spent so much time just on, oh, I love having my characters be in this time period, that the overall plot would kind of just grind to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know, I think this sort of forward moving intertwining of an actual more moving plot along with all those details is what I was hoping for from her book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she's done in other books, like the Doomsday book or the one about near-death experience.
Passage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I just was like, yes, this is what I wanted.
Yeah, my feeling about Blackout was it was exactly what I expected it to be, I think.
Okay.
So what was interesting to me was the floating around in the Blitz.
Mm-hmm.
That was the historical stuff. That's what I was reading the book for, I think. You know, not that I think it's the best novel of all time or anything like that,
but that's what interested me about it.
Yeah, and that's what interested me about it, and that's why I was reading it, and that's what she gave me. So I was, that's how I felt about it.
I was interested in the story. Mm-hmm. I did not get so much of that. So that's why. But the other thing is, there were some themes in here that were fascinating in terms of there are constant references to the Eucharist. These characters are constantly talking or thinking little things about body and blood of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And I was actually at Mass thinking about this book when I was about 2/3 of the way through it.
Mm-hmm.
And it suddenly occurred to me that it's fascinating to think about the fact that you've got the Eucharist, which is people eating the body and blood of Jesus Christ. And he juxtaposes it with Hale's and everyone's experience in the Genie's attack in 1948, where, you know, Elena thinks cannibal.
Mm-hmm.
And through their mind melding, I guess, with the djinn of what's going on, the genies, the fallen angels, are eating the men.
Mm-hmm.
That's the wrong, that's the horror of it. Instead of, you know, the Christian ideal would be you love and serve each other. The djinn, the fallen angels, are the exact opposite. They're preying on men.
Mm-hmm.
And using them. And the men themselves are seeking to use the djinn. It's a completely, you know, for their own purposes, which is to flout the natural law. They want to, giant spoiler, they want to be immortal.
Mm-hmm.
Which means they want to.
The whole thing driving the plot of the book, you know, why the spies are involved and everything like that.
Part of it is because, and this is the other thing, I was just like, oh man, blowing my mind, Tim Powers, hat off from Catholic point of view. Because the part of it is men want immortality. And when these angels die or are killed, their bodies fall and they're absorbed by this certain sort of a thistle.
Mm-hmm.
You can process this thistle in a certain sort of way. You eat it and you remain immortal, which means you don't age at all and you still have a vigorous life or whatever. And some people they meet later have experienced that. And so it's what everybody's after. But what the countries are after is the good influence, powerful influence on their behalf of these angels who are guardians of cities and of countries.
Hmm. Yep.
And Hale several times encounters the fallen angel, I guess, who the Russians have co-opted to protect their country. So I'm not sure if that angel was just guarding Moscow, but I think it might have been all of Russia. Mm-hmm. But because one of the goals of the Andrew Hales group was to overthrow it so that the Soviet Union would fall, which is also fascinating.
Which is really fascinating. You know, I kept, you know, and gosh, maybe I missed it, but mm-hmm. did they mention Pope John Paul wasn't in this book because it was way too soon. But I kept thinking, you know, the influence that Pope John Paul II had on the
Poland.
Fall of communism. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. yeah, that was... Oh, speaking of Poland, I had a Polish priest visit this weekend at our church, our little tiny church we had.
Uh-huh.
Cool. Our new priest brought in this other guy who was from Poland. I guess he is stationed here in Idaho, so he's been in the United States for a long time. But
like missionary work.
Yeah, but no, he does parish work, I think. But anyway,
he's like a... It's like going to Africa to be a priest always. When he came to this
maybe
country.
So,
I
right.
always look at those people like, oh, you're missionaries. Thank you.
That is funny. That is funny.
Yeah.
But it was neat. I talked to him a little bit.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So I said, hey, do you know who Stanislaw Lem is? You know, I still want to look into another thing Kurt Jester pointed out in a comment on on our last one on Contact. Yeah. He mentioned that Stanislaw Lem and Pope John Paul II knew each other.
And
that just fascinates the heck out of me. So I can't wait to look into that and see what I can find.
I know. Can you imagine the conversations?
Oh, I just can't imagine.
And this so holy man.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
But he was so human.
You know,
I could just see them laughing and poking each other verbally over coffee.
Exactly. It would be neat if any of their conversations was noted somehow, but I certainly doubt it, but it would be neat to read what I can find about that.
Yeah. Well, definitely let me know.
Yeah, for certain.
But anyway, the whole thing I was going to say about the angels is that's part of Catholic theology. And I'm not going to go into why and wherefore, but I've read a couple of books that talk about this. One by Cardinal Jean Donnelly, if I'm saying that right. It's an older book. And then one by Mike Aquilina about angels. But basically, angels, there are guardian angels just as there are of us. There are guardian angels of principalities, so to speak. So countries, cities and all that. And so that all tied in with the other thing that's a Catholic, I don't know if it's a Catholic teaching, but it's a Catholic thought for sure, and you might know, which is that in the Old Testament, the gods that people worshipped, like Baal or Moloch, were actually demons, which is fallen angels, who had set themselves up as gods because they can do all those angelic things and fool people into thinking that they're doing it for good.
Right.
So that's where you work your way into, you know, child sacrifice or human sacrifice and all that kind of thing. So the Catholic way of thinking is not that necessarily always that these people just made these things up, but these could have been real entities that were calling for blood sacrifice to everyone's detriment.
Just that
tie-in with this book, I was just like, wow, he didn't miss a trick.
Yeah, and that is something else, you know, in that the personal level. I recall a point where Andrew Hale is pushed to despair by some spiritual force. So that's what this angel is using against him, is making him despair.
Right.
And he had to overcome that, and he had to realize that that was coming from elsewhere. And that was a really interesting moment in there. But again, that's sound stuff. You know, that's... I believe that can happen.
Yeah. Well, and you can see that the way it's written is so good, because at that moment, I remember it now, but you can see inside his mind, he obviously is not thinking this is coming from outside initially.
Right. Yeah.
But you can see it is just by little hints. And so you're just on tenterhooks the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I found it interesting that this is something I think that's this search for immortality. It so happens that when I was reading this book, I read in the Wall Street Journal, I didn't read the whole article, but there was a huge feature piece in the Weekend Journal about man's search to push the age of death from what, the 70s or 80s or whatever, 90s, whatever you can expect, to 150.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I always look at that stuff and go, really, you want me to have 60 more years of paying bills and working? And and it's not that life isn't good, but it's like, wouldn't that just be more of the same thing over and over and over? And it made me think of a quote from my quote journal, which, if anybody knows me as happy Catholic, that's my thing. But actually, it was so timely because Pope Benedict had given a homily, I believe it was around Easter time sometime, which would make sense, where he talks about immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And do you mind if I read?
No, please do.
Yeah. It's a little bit long, but he says, man's resistance to death becomes evident. Somewhere, people have constantly thought there must be some cure for death. What would it really be like if we were to succeed? Perhaps not in excluding death totally, but in postponing it indefinitely, in reaching an age of several hundred years. Would that be a good thing? Humanity would become extraordinarily old. There would be no more room for youth. Capacity for innovation would die, and endless life would be no paradise, if anything, a condemnation. The true cure for death must be different. It cannot lead simply to an indefinite prolongation of this current life. It would have to transform our lives from within. It would need to create a new life within us, truly fit for eternity. It would need to transform us in such a way as not to become an end with death, as to come to an end with death, but only then to begin in fullness. What is new and exciting in the Christian message, in the gospel of Jesus Christ, was and is that we are told, yes, indeed, this cure for death, this true medicine of immortality does exist. It has been found. It is within our reach. In baptism, this medicine is given to us. A new life begins in us, a life that matures in faith and is not extinguished by the death of the old life, but is only then revealed. Indeed, the cure for death does exist. Christ is the tree of life, once more within our reach. If we remain close to him, then we have life.
Hmm. Terrific, of course. Wow.
Well, yeah. And for me, that was just... Obviously, I liked it when I read it because I wrote it all down. But to me, in conjunction with what these men were striving for, it really showed the wrong thinking of, I'm so terrified of death.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't thinking properly or just hadn't expanded their minds enough around the idea of what is heaven.
Yeah. Yeah, and they discussed that explicitly at one point, I recall. Especially Andrew Hale, I remember him thinking that, you know, he wasn't ready to go. And when he finally confronted, he was horrified, not because, well, it was because of having to deal with his life.
Everybody's afraid of having to confess. In fact, you're right. I don't know why I'd forgotten that. You're right. The reason they don't want they don't want to die is they're afraid of facing all their acts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, why all these Catholics just don't go to confession at that point, I don't know.
Exactly.
If they believe everything else, but they kind of, I guess they can't, you know, we all avoid the confessional.
Mm-hmm.
Why does this podcast always come back to confession?
I don't know.
We're always bringing it up, but I guess there's a reason. It's a really powerful sacrament.
Yeah, it really is.
And it would have ended the book, so.
Yeah, probably so. Probably so.
But they're just desperate to avoid that last judgment, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't stop and think about, if you make that sacrifice, and good heavens, they're making horrible sacrifices all the time, and they're living through these horrible events, that what's on the other side for that sacrifice is something unimaginable. Maybe it's because it's unimaginable.
Yeah, maybe so.
And I was reading, I'm sorry to just start dominating this.
No,
but
you're fine.
It's something I had taken a lot of notes on.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading this book, Catholicism, by Robert Barron.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It goes along with I can't remember if I've mentioned it here before. It goes along with a 10-part video that he's done of what is basically the faith in one book. In one series. And I know it's airing on a lot of public TV, not in Texas. Thank you for nothing. Four parts of it are. But mm-hmm. This book is an accompaniment, and it's really, I can't recommend it highly enough. There's, of course, I'm super critical, so there's a couple chapters I wish he'd have written in a different way, mm-hmm. but they're all great. And each one of them has images that kind of spurred me on to think about things in new ways, so it was very exciting to read.
Oh, cool.
And one of the things was he took the images of heaven and talked about a couple of them. And, you know, there's all these images. There's the banquet. There are the new heaven and the new earth. There's the new Jerusalem. And the banquet's easy to imagine. You know, you're with all the people you ever loved or that you didn't know influenced you. You're having a big party. But he started talking about things like the new Jerusalem, which I realized as I was reading it, I always thought of as being an extremely sterile place. Mm-hmm. Because when you read about it in, oh gosh, which prophet is it? Is it Isaiah who has the vision of it? And the Revelation, the book of Revelation, I know mm-hmm. John does. But anyway, I'm sorry, I don't know these things. I didn't look them up. But he starts talking about, well, let's think about this for a minute. Think about a vibrant, bustling city. And I suddenly went, oh my gosh, I love Chicago. I love Paris. I love London. I love San Francisco, New Orleans, all these places. And he goes, now, it's full of all these people. It's lively. It's exciting. There's all this stuff going on. And I'm getting more interested as I read. And he goes, now, imagine that all these people, angels and people, are completely in harmony. Not the same, mm-hmm. but we all understand and believe and know what's really true. So that when we talk to each other, there's this excitement and this spark of, like when you and I are talking on this podcast and we go, wow, that was so great all day long. I'm like, we're writing each other little emails about that point was great. This is exciting. I hadn't thought about this. Here's some new information. Mm-hmm. A whole city of that mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah. Fantastic. Cool.
And I was, yeah. went, oh my gosh, I want to go to there. You know?
Yeah.
And he was talking about the new heaven and the new earth the same way. You think about it and you go, oh yeah, I can't imagine. And he goes, we don't have to imagine. We're here on earth right now. Mm-hmm. It will be perfect. What is the earth that you want perfect? The one where the animals, you know, you don't find the squirrel that died from something awful. You don't, your trees aren't falling over. Your whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no pollution. And he goes, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, I also want to go to there, you know? And he goes, and everybody there is like, hey, isn't this the greatest, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's, we don't think big enough when we allow ourselves to be confined by, you know, oh yeah, the new heaven and the new earth, the banquet, but we don't invest our imaginations in it. Or I don't, let yeah. me say. You might. Which
no,
would be-
I actually, I'm learning to. It's kind of funny that you mention it because I've been listening to a podcast. Have you heard of Pray As You Go?
Yeah, that's a really great one, actually.
Yeah, and I started listening to that just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
And it's done by some Jesuits in Britain, I believe. Mm-hmm, I don't have any huge details. Yeah,
it's really great.
Yeah, and it's really great. And one of the things that they do is they read a Bible passage and then they start, again, I think we've talked about this in the past. There's a Jesuit way of prayer that you imagine yourself in the events that were happening.
Yeah.
So they do that in this podcast. They read a passage of scripture and then they, you know, there's a brief discussion. Well, not really a discussion. It's just a like a paragraph.
Well, there's some questions. They aren't yeah. there some like leading questions. Where
exactly
they go, now,
right.
Think about
exactly.
This.
And the thing about this, and often they say, now picture yourself there. What was this like? What would it mm-hmm. have been like to be in the crowd watching the Sermon on the Mount? What would that have been like? And then they let you, you know, think about that. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that just triggered my thought on that because I love it. So I'm learning to, you know, put my imagination to work that way.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that podcast because I used to listen to it and it's really wonderfully set up because they play some music first mm-hmm. and it's anything from classical to chant to, well, classical meaning, you know, music centered around the mass to, you know, nun singing to Lady Blacksmith Magombo to, mm-hmm.
yeah, all kinds of things.
Yeah. All kinds of stuff, but it's always a piece of praise music or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then they'll read the verse or, you know, the scripture for the day or whatever. And then they'll ask those questions and then music plays while you think about it. Mm-hmm. And then they always come back and go, now listen again and And sometimes they'll tell you, think about this, and they'll or sometimes they'll just say, listen again. And then at the end, there's always an invitation put as a question of, now, did you think about these images? Tell Jesus this, or what is God saying to you here? Or, and it really forces you into a personal connection. And that's been very effective for me. And I kind of stopped listening because my spiritual director was, I don't think he's a fan as much of Ignatian spirituality. He's kind of afraid you kind of get caught in a loop of your own imagining.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a way to do it that is not just self-directed. And so I like that. It's just because it's just like 5 minutes long or
Yeah, it's about 10 minutes. Is
10
what
minutes
they have
long,
been.
Okay.
Yeah,
that I was thinking I might start listening to that again because I have sometimes I've been driving along and suddenly going, I didn't expect to have a little encounter with God this morning, but guess what? That put me in the place where I was totally surprised because I did.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Oh, good.
But that's the thing about heaven
mm-hmm.
is the images that Christ used to those people or that, you know, come through the book of Revelation sometimes are things that I myself think of in a very sterile fashion because I'm not investing it with what is the true purpose behind heaven, which is to see God and be with him always and experience that friendship that all of us should have in a perfect way
mm-hmm.
because we're all part of the same thing, but still individuals, which is the coolest thing about Christianity is versus like, is it Buddhism
mm-hmm.
or maybe some others that say, oh, we kind of all dissolve into the great knowledge that's mm-hmm. out there or the great mind of God or whatever they call it.
Right.
I'm not knowledgeable about that mm-hmm. you know, very much, but
yeah. Interesting. Yeah. One other kind of, serendipitous moment I had was, again with Kurt Jester's blog. So this is the all Kurt Jester all the time.
Oh yes. doesn't get better than that.
You
really.
Bet. So there's a moment in the book where, Hale is awestruck because he's actually in the presence of one of these angels. And he begins to think, I am looking at something that has seen the face of God. So it's like 1 degree of separation. And then as I'm thinking about that, there's a post on Kurt Jester's blog about degrees of separation.
And that's right. That was yesterday or the day before.
So, right. And he was, he started with Kevin Bacon. You know, and he was thinking about Kevin Bacon's degrees of separation. And then, you know, on one hand, you know, we're 0 degrees of separation from Christ ourselves right. because we can contact him ourselves. But when you think about it,
right.
you know, when we meet a bishop, we're like 1 degree of separation from the Pope. Because, you know, most of these guys have been in the Pope's presence. And
that's right.
And it's just interesting to think about.
Well, and the Pope is a bishop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's the Bishop of Rome.
Right.
So,
yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I think about that stuff often, too. You know, I can imagine, you know, like our priest, you know, and a bishop put his hands on the priest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a cardinal or whatever put his hands on the bishop. But when you think about it, and you can go all the way back through history to Christ.
Which is what I was like, oh my gosh, and Christ put his hands on Peter.
Exactly. Yeah.
And he breathed on them. I was thinking about this because I was, I was reading in this RCIA book, it's talking about the Holy Spirit because my husband and I are helping with that. That's the chapter for this week. And they were talking about how often the Holy Spirit is imaged as wind or breath. Ruah, I think is how you say it. That's the word for God. And as wind and breath. And I was thinking about the fact that the three synoptic gospels have the event of Pentecost in the upper room. But the gospel of John does it in a way that I love, which is when Jesus comes back to them in the locked upper room, he breathes on them. That is the moment of Pentecost for them in that book. It is God. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he breathed the Holy Spirit onto Peter. And all those apostles who then, as you said, through history have put their hands on all. Wow.
Yeah.
You've blown my mind. Thank you.
Oh, you bet.
That's a wonderful image.
Yeah. Thanks, Kurt Jester.
Yeah, thank you. Well, Jeff, we have to thank you for this podcast in general.
Yes, we do.
And this, I've got to buy this book because it definitely needs rereading.
I know
there are more layers that Tim Powers put in here than I saw, and there was so much.
No, there's so much. And I'm so eager. The next one of Powers' books I'm going to read is Last Call.
Okay.
Last Call was actually, I just can't recall where I got this list, but a long time ago I got a list of the, somebody wrote a list, you know, the 10 best horror novels of all time. And
oh, really?
I was interested to see that Last Call was on that list.
Hmm.
So I don't know what kind of horror I'm in for. but the other things that were on their list, that list, were things like Salem's Lot and The Shining. Yeah. There was two Stephen Kings on it.
Yeah.
Some Robert McCammon, one called Boy's Life, which I have not read.
Uh-huh.
Have you read that one?
No, but I just came across his, what is it, the something of the swan?
Oh, Swan Song.
Swan Song, where they said it's like The Stand, but so different from The Stand. And so that's just gone onto my list of books to read. So that's my first encounter with him.
Interesting. Yeah. So, but anyway, so I was really interested to see that Last Call is on there. And Last Call is the first book in a trilogy. One of them's called Earthquake Weather, and I can't recall what the last one's called. Oh, Expiration Date, maybe.
I could
be wrong.
Earlier books, right? Because I was looking through his books, thinking I'd like to read something else by him.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard of Last Call, and I think Will Duquette also had said maybe that last. I think he's the one who said that Last Call would be one he'd recommend for us to read.
Oh, great!
And talk about. So I already kind of had that on my radar.
Yeah.
So I'll have to put that on my. Okay. But if you get to it first, please.
Oh, sure.
I've got so many books to read.
As do I, but it's joyous.
I get too many review books, and then I see too many great books being talked about. And so I've got 200 books on my list and a huge stack of books that have been sent to me. And it's
for sure.
It's like being in a good kind of school, but still school. Yeah. But
And you know, I didn't elaborate at all. You know, when I got to meet Tim Powers at one time at the convention we were at, he did a panel where they talked about religion and science fiction. And this convention was in Salt Lake City. So largely LDS population.
Right.
So I was there in the audience, and he said to the folks, you know, in his introduction, he said, "I am Catholic and there are no caveats. There is no, but I am Catholic
I
and I accept the whole thing." You know, and that was, I was like, hey, how cool is that? You know, so.
And rare.
And rare, yeah. And then they talked about how a person's religion affects their writing. And I find Declare just an excellent example of, you know, Catholicism is all over in this book, but it's not preachy in any way. It's just that the way that the characters are acting.
It's a truth that they accept, like they accept that jinns exist. And so anybody who's not Catholic reading it or not even Christian reading it doesn't have to necessarily feel like they're being slapped with the Catholicism. It's just this is part of the worldview of this book. But he's representing it absolutely correctly in the way it's being used here.
Right. And that's exactly what he said in the panel. You know, it was a long time ago. But what I got out of that panel was that everybody agreed, not just him, but everybody agreed that when you set out to write a book that's going to be influenced by religion and you're trying to make a point, your book is probably going to be bad. And he said, you know, your viewpoint comes out when you write, whether you like it to or not. So in that way, he says, a person could say that my books have a Catholic influence, but he doesn't set out to write Catholic books. He's not out trying to, he doesn't have this agenda.
And he's popular with all kinds of
people. Yeah, he is popular with all kinds of folks, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the testament to the fact that he basically is genuinely being who he is, which is a talented writer, but one who hears my worldview, and so I represent it. Much the same way that somebody like Robert Sawyer is... God, the greatest ideas, I don't always feel that he carries them out as fully as he could, which I always am kind of disappointed about.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody has one of his books to recommend that way, I guess one we should read sometime is, what's that one?
Oh,
with
Calculating
the
God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because that talks so directly about God, but he is so clearly also what he is. Mm-hmm. He is not, a believer. He has a certain political viewpoint, and that comes out in the books. And I still like the books. I still will read them,
mm-hmm.
but you just know who the person is who wrote it. That's all.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily affect the enjoyment of it one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree.
And The Lord of the Rings is the classic example, which mm-hmm. nobody knew it was. The guy was Catholic. Tolkien was Catholic at all until fairly recently. I mean, in terms of knowing that and reading his books.
Yeah, yeah.
It was when the movies came out, all of a sudden the articles come out going, he was Catholic and here was his worldview and blah, blah. And you go, oh, now that it's been pointed out, I see it. But I read these things and loved the movies and you didn't have to know that.
Right, right.
But there's the value in telling the truth while you're telling the story too. Mm. So.
Yep, and that's it. That's the key right there. I think that's a key element of an excellent writer.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Yep, for sure. I guess that's a good spot for us to call it a show.
I think so.
All right.
So, speaking of telling the truth while you're telling a story, mm-hmm. I just want to put in a plug here for I saw a Machine Gun Preacher.
Ooh, okay.
I got to go to an early screening of it. And, oh, what a powerful movie.
Ooh.
This is not a movie he's Christian and mm-hmm. it's inspirational, but this isn't about being Christian. I mean, it's if it was later in the year and possibly didn't have so much Christianity in it, just because it is who this guy is, I would say it was an Oscar contender. I liked it that much. Mm. It stars Gerard Butler. It has also Michelle Monaghan. It was directed by Mark Forster, who did Quantum of Solace, Stranger Than Fiction. He directed Stranger Than Fiction.
Oh, wow.
All kinds of movies, Finding Neverland, Monsters mm-hmm. Ball.
Yeah.
I mean, and they threw everything they had into this movie in terms of it is just a great quality movie. And I've never seen Gerard Butler actually flat out act the way he did in this, I think.
And
fantastic. I've seen different kinds of reviews. Some people say it's too simple. Other people like me go, well, they didn't take you by the hand and lead you. That's true, to tell you speeches about everything. But it's basically about a guy who was a very, very bad man. I was surprised to see in the beginning of the movie just how bad he was. He becomes a Christian, and in trying to live out his faith, he hears somebody who's an African missionary talk about how everybody's your brother. So he starts by helping the people around him he knows, which are the prostitutes, the bikers, the drug users, which is who he'd like this movie to speak to, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want it to speak to Christians necessarily. He goes, if I have my way, the people who need to see it are the people who aren't Christian. But, and then he goes to Africa because he's a carpenter and he thinks he'll help them build some of their houses. And he goes out to see the countryside with one of the African freedom fighters and comes face to face with the Civil War, which includes the Boys' Army. I don't know if everybody mm-hmm. knows about that, but most people do. And then he says, well, forget this. I'm going to build an orphanage so all these kids can have somewhere to go. And it goes from there.
Oh, wow.
Because he has to be able to defend it, because pretty soon they're like, we don't like this. We want these kids for our own uses. And he's like, no, I love my guns, and here I'm going to use them.
Oh, wow.
And they're, you know, and it's about personal development in your faith. How do you live it? What do you do when there's a crisis of faith? How much are you expected to carry? How much does God carry for you? It's very powerful.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So
sounds like something that we're going to be talking about someday.
Yeah. Excellent. You don't have to rush out early, because guess what? We will be talking about it.
Fantastic.
So, so I just want to plug it. If it's around, it's not for kids. It's earned its R rating, but it's really great.
Okay.
So
cool.
I'll have a written review up later.
All right. Sounds good. Well, next up for us is October Fun.
Oh, yes.
Shaun of the
lighter.
Dead. Yeah, Shaun of the Dead. I can't wait. That's going to be fun. Zombies. Yeah. It's
and
about time
British
we got humor. Back. Yep.
Right. And then Ray Bradbury, Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Fantastic. Yep.
And then Thanksgiving and then, month, November.
Yep. We'll be talking about The Social Network, which is really an excuse to talk about social networks in general, as far as I'm concerned. So, and then Way Station by Clifford D. Simak.
Yeah, which is a great book.
Yes. Yeah.
I love it.
Great.
And then Christmas. Shall I announce the Christmas?
Ooh, you're welcome.
I don't think
to.
I've even told you, have I?
You told me one of them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The movie Tokyo Godfathers.
Ooh, okay. That
have
one you
that?
Haven't told me. Nope, I don't know anything about it.
It's anime.
Okay.
So, like, you know, Jesse from SFF Audio said he's never seen anime. He understood. You might like this because it's not science fiction.
Okay.
And then, Hogfather by Terry Pratchett.
That's the one that you told me.
Yeah.
Cool. How fascinating. Which, that'll be great.
Yeah. And all, right. and all shorter. Easier to read.
Yes. And right. I apologize.
Giving us a little rest.
You bet. So we can start January with something immense. I'll find
yes.
something.
Let's War and Peace. Here we come.
Heck yeah.
Or
something. I got to start compiling a list. Well, I do already have a list, but start to think about next year. Because we're going to keep doing this, right?
Duh.
All right then. Cool.
Yes. That's too much fun for me.
Yeah. It's a good time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, when real life doesn't intrude, darn it.
It is fun, but it is fun. So, you know, when real life intrudes, real life is more important always.
Right.
The face-to-face, which is actually why I started helping with RCIA. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, eventually you have to meet real people where you can kind of let them rub off some of your rough corners.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And other stuff. Hopefully you can help a little bit where you're needed. So.
For sure.
Anyway.
All right. Well, thanks very, very much. And we're actually going to do Shaun of the Dead in 1 week.
Yeah, so, we're going to get back on schedule.
Yep, we'll get right back on schedule. So
we'll be talking again soon.
Yep. We'll see you soon. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.